We have two bills on our agenda, and we're going to start with House Bill 2366. But before I get started, I know somebody has signed up for 2354, Jonathan Clay. Are you here every day, or did you travel down from Portland on this bill? Specifically on this bill?
For today.
Okay. I may want to roll this bill over to Monday, but if you would like to deliver your testimony on it and not come back on Monday, that would be fine too. So it's up to you. There's going to be other testimony on Monday, though.
It's a big deal. The chair is giving you the power.
So, you know, if you would like to deliver testimony on this bill, maybe I'd open it up real quick and get that testimony on the record and then move on.
I'm happy to wait until Monday when
everyone else. It's entirely up to you. I apologize for that. I just got calls from a couple other people who wouldn't be able to be here, and so entirely up to you. If you want to testify today, I'm more than willing to open it up. It is on the agenda. But there will be other discussion on Monday if you want to be included on that.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. Thank you for the information.
Okay, thank you. So, colleagues, we'll just be hearing House Bill 2366 today. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2366. And Victoria, you want to give us a little summary of the bill, please?
Will do. House Bill 2366 establishes the Residential Structure Lien Assistance Fund to be administered by the Construction Contractors Board. It allows capped payouts from the fund to certain lien claimants if owner has paid construction contractor, but the contractor has not paid the claimant. Requires paid lien claimant to file satisfaction of lien or judgment. Appropriates monies from the general fund for 2009-2011 biennium and requires repayment no later than June 30th of 2011. Fund will be continually replenished through a surcharge not to exceed $40 on application for issuance or renewal of residential contractor endorsement, effective on passage with first payment from fund to occur during calendar year 2010.
Thank you. And with that, colleagues, let me give you a little preamble to add on to that one. This sounds pretty complicated, but I want to have you concentrate on the concept. There are some issues with this particular bill that need to be changed and need to be worked on, and my intent is to work on this concept and see if we can fashion something that addresses this particular problem. I took a stab at drafting something myself without a lot of input because and that's why this bill seems kind of complicated at the moment. So I'm hoping that with the committee's help and with some agencies and other stakeholders that we will be able to craft a solution to this particular problem, which you may or may not be familiar with, but you will become familiar with it shortly. So I've never given that kind of a caveat on a bill before, but I have to take some responsibility for it. So with that, I did open the public hearing, correct?
Yes.
And I think I'm going to have Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board come up first. And colleagues, this bill and concept is actually, a synergy between two concepts that were before this committee last session, as Representative Gilliam and Representative Riley might remember from the Construction Claims Task Force recommendations. And neither of those concepts moved forward, and I sort of combined them to solve a specific problem. And with the help of our stakeholders and the committee, maybe we can figure out what to do with this issue. All right. Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. It's a pleasure to be back before this committee. I've spent some wonderful hours before this committee in past sessions, and it's a privilege to be here. I'm joined today by my colleague, Bill Boyd. Bill Boyd is a lawyer, but he's still okay, and he serves to manage our dispute resolution program, and he has a deep background in construction law and has a background in mediation in dispute resolution. Also knows quite a bit about Oregon liens law. I chatted briefly with the chair today, trying to figure out what I could do to help you with this matter. As Chair Holvey has indicated, obviously this is not a CCB-sponsored bill, but the topic is one that's dear to this agency's heart, and that is the consumer risk that is out there with the way the lien law is currently written. Today, a consumer who pays in full for a job performed on a remodeling project under $50,000, and in some other cases as well, has a possibility of having to pay twice for the same goods and services. It's the way the lien law is put together. There are some good reasons for that. We can talk about that. Perhaps we can illustrate that with the PowerPoint that we have on the lien law today. But it's a problem, obviously, for consumers who find it very difficult when they find out that even after they paid their general contractor in full, that they're at risk for a construction lien and ultimately the sale of their residence if they didn't pay for those goods and services to the sub and supplier that has those lien rights. So with that said, I'd like to just briefly go over what we prepared for you so you know what's here, and then perhaps we can refer back to it, and it would help me to answer questions so I can, I think that would be a better way to spend some time so we can have that kind of dialogue. Executive summary on the first page of what this bill does. I described the problem. What this bill would do is provide a fund so that people who have had to pay twice would have some relief. It's important, obviously, to address this problem. It's been a perennial one for many years. We've tried to solve this problem and have, to a great degree, in years past. We'll talk about some of those solutions. What will happen if we don't pass this? Well, obviously, the status quo will be remain. The agency hopes that you choose to give this due consideration and perhaps provide some additional protection for consumers regarding this pay-twice problem. Again, to outline what we have here on page 2 and 3.
Craig, just a moment for a second.
Could I roll a question out here so that I make sure that in your presentation, this is completely new to me, and until just a couple seconds ago, I had no idea what anybody was talking about. But I get what you just said. So help me through. Is this problem existing because perhaps someone would pay their contractor in full, and then the contractor wouldn't pay the subs, and then that's how it would come back on the original? Okay. I just want to make sure that, because that's where my thought process was going, that I was going in the right direction. As you explain this to me now, I can listen better. Thank you.
You're right on target, Representative Cowan.
That's amazing.
Thank you. And Chair Holvey and Representative Cohen, thank you. Again, page 2 and 3 is a detailed analysis of the current bill. There are some issues that you may want to address on down the line. I think if I can draw your attention to page 4 in this presentation, it shows back in 1982 what your Builders Board brought to you, this problem, and suggested that we ought to come up with a solution. And the solution at that time was a notice requirement. And the notice requirement is for the primary contractor to give to the consumer a piece of paper produced by this agency that tells them that they're at risk. We have a copy of that piece of paper as it stands today, so you can see what it looks like. It's given out today more than it used to be. There was a time when those were rarely given out. I think the construction industry has stepped up to the plate, and in many cases that piece of paper is given out. In 1983, then Representative Merkley also tried to tackle this problem and did a good job with the Home Buyers Protection Act of that year. It really addressed the issue of new construction, at least a portion of the new construction market. In 2007, We appeared before you with House Bill then 2113. That was a solution that I can't tell you that we had popular support for, but made sense to your Construction Contractors Board and yours truly. And that was that the consumer would have an ultimate defense. If they could prove that they paid their for their services in full to their general, the sub and supplier would not be able to go after the house. It was a simple solution, but there are some problems with it, and it ultimately did not become law. So that's a history, a brief history of this problem throughout the years. I think, again, I'd like to share with you, just for reference purposes, on pages 6 and 7 and 8, we have an outline about what the Construction Contractors Board is all about. On page 9 and 10, a further explanation about what Bill's program is and how it serves to address some of these types of complaints. Page number 11 is that pay-twice notice that primary contractors are obligated to give. You can see how that's put together. And page 13 is a right-to-lien notice, a little different notice, that needs to be provided by subbing suppliers to the owner of the property. On page number 15 is the cover sheet for our dispute resolution quarterly report, and that's followed by one page of that report, page 16. And I bring that to your attention because it shows how many complaints we receive in this area. And that's on page 16, line item 602, lien complaints. And you can see how many complaints we get per quarter and the fact that those complaints are going up. And I think that's a function of the economy. As the economy weakens, we have subs and suppliers who aren't being paid at a greater rate. That's absolutely is in conflict, however, with the amount of construction work which we have today. And on page number 17, you'll see the building permits for new and single-family residential construction for three cities. And you can see things have not been good in the industry that we regulate. Times are tough. I think you all know that. Rounding out this this presentation is an explanation by Mr. Boyd in his memo to me on page 18 that gives a further light on this subject, and also some data that he may refer to on the following pages, and of course finally a copy of the bill.
Mr. Chair. Somebody say something?
Yeah. Representative Wingard.
I read these two stories, and I'm still at a loss. You know, I'm totally new to the subject, but how is it that a homeowner who pays a contractor money for material can face the prospect of a lien from somebody, some material supplier? I mean, isn't there a right of action against the contractor or the person who bought the material from them that didn't pay their debt? I mean, I just don't understand how the homeowner gets dragged in on this.
Right.
How can they possibly be put in a situation where they have to pay twice?
Chair Hovey and Representative Wingard, that's the part that doesn't seem intuitive and is most distressing, I think, to your regulators here and to Oregonians. It doesn't seem to make sense, except if you happen to be a supplier or a sub. When you go out and in good faith do a good job of providing product under the guise that you're going to get paid, and the lien laws are set up so you have a right, you have some rights in case you're not paid. And they extend past whether or not the contractor runs off with the money or not. And there's some practical reasons for that, and we'll discuss those, but they run right into what I think is unfair and what many of us think is unfair for the consumer.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Follow up.
I get it that when somebody fails to pay, somebody has to eat the cost. You know, I mean, this is part of the business model. I mean, somebody doesn't pay, then somebody's out, but if the homeowner paid the contractor, and the contractor then establishes a relationship with a sub,
right,
and the sub decides to give that contractor credit,
right,
and not require payment up front, they are the ones who end up out if the contractor doesn't pay. That's the relationship between them, and they can sue or maybe go after a lien on that contractor's home or what. I mean, that seems to be the appropriate. I just don't understand how the homeowner, right, who paid the contractor gets dragged into the process because the sub didn't get paid.
Chair Holby,
go ahead. And I'll let you answer it.
Representative Wingard, that was the reason we brought last season House Bill 2113, because we didn't think that made sense either. And we just think the balance of fairness is such that consumers ought to be held harmless if they can prove that they paid their general in full. If I can wait, because you're going to hear from some folks that have some compelling arguments to the contrary and maybe can articulate the reason why the lien law exists better than I can. And we'll also, if with your indulgence, we'll go through the lien law as it's written today, what your predecessors have done throughout the last 100 or 200 years is provide a lot of notice so consumers should know that they're at this risk. It's up to policymakers to decide whether or not the risk is worth the benefit, and the benefit, again, the industry can talk about as well as I can. So,
and certainly, Representative Wingard, that this is a complicated issue. I understand your reasoning, but there's also, you know, the lien laws were established to make sure that people get paid for doing work and they get paid for their services initially, and that. And there's many kinds of liens that you can put on property to ensure that there's some asset that is there that will make sure that you get paid. And if you don't get paid, you attach a lien to that asset, and that's generally how the problem gets started. But and then the relationship between the sub and the contractor gets into the picture, and we're in this situation, and it's been that way for many, many years. And not this isn't the only state that has this problem. But anyway, please continue.
Well, Chair Holby, that's a great point. You know, we do participate in discussions with other states. I can tell you other states struggle with this. They have not come up with a better solution than Oregon has, to my knowledge. I think it's a credit to your committee that you're tackling this again and spending time on it. Perhaps you'll come up with something this year. If there are no additional questions, we'll go ahead through kind of a basic training on lien law. It's a little bit boring. Let me give that to you right off the bat, but I think it's a great foundation for your discussion here.
Representative Widener.
If I may fire one quick question, because I might have to leave before they finish with lien tax law, and that's one I'm wondering about. Because I've studied this and talked to a few people about this, but what if we took this and added it to the new home construction bill that protects the new home construction? Is there any way of making a link or a tie to that current bill that's in place that's protecting people on the new home building side? That's just kind of a thought process I've had with this and doing an amendment where we just tie it into an existing bill possibly that already has a fee going into it that isn't being used up and that we haven't had any issues with.
Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, I think that that's a legitimate discussion point as well, and may be the best solution. I haven't thought about it entirely, but I have heard it talked about. I think what I'm hearing you suggest is, what about the current 2003 legislation and maybe we can broaden that out. That might also be a solution you want to take a hard look at.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Do you think you're set?
Well, we need somebody to come with a pass.
While we're meeting, Mr. Chair, if I could just make one comment.
Representative Riley.
Now that people who are new on this committee understand the angst that we had last session with the absolute same thing. Why on earth is it like this? We all said that at the beginning, and at the end we were still saying, why on earth is it like this? But you'll see.
Chair, are we waiting on?
Yeah.
If we have a moment, maybe Harry.
We have a moment? Representative Barton certainly will allow you
to. If we have a moment, of course. Because this really isn't important. But
anything to delay the presentation on lien law.
Representative Barton, you got something to say?
We're ready to go. I'll pass.
No, we're not.
Well, in that case, Mr. Chair, allow me to state that I've been. This presentation we're about to have on Oregon lien law, I believe it's ORS 87 off the top of my head, you know, and in my professional career, which admittedly is only about 3 years long, but it is, I have never dealt with statute more turgid and difficult to interpret and truly ambiguous than ORS 87. And whenever I've had to litigate this chapter several times, and when you have, for example, a room full of lawyers debating over what the statute actually means, even in basic things like procedure, filing a dispute, etc. It is, I just think that this would be an excellent, even if we don't want to make substantive changes in any way, shape, or form, I think this would be a good candidate to try and clarify the language there.
You promised
certainly
to
I could
this
I
bill.
Could let you have a word.
I can't wait to learn what it means. 87.
I just want to know what turgid means.
You can take it to the judiciary.
Anyway. Well established. And his fourth birthday is coming up.
Chair Holvey, this is Bill Boyd speaking. I did some research at one time to see just how old Oregon's law is, and I stopped at 1900. It goes back before that. You can find cases, and when you read the cases, you discover the law wasn't very different. Some of the notices that we have today didn't exist back in the early part of the 20th century. But other than that, the basic structure where a sub or a material person who doesn't get paid can file a lien, that did exist. And I don't know the whys and the reasons for the way the law is structured. I don't think they're lost in time, but you'd have to go back before the turn of that century to discover why they chose to do this. There are a few states, and I think it's just a few, that do what we tried to do last session, which was to make a complete defense, the idea that you have that you've paid the general, and the general just hasn't passed that payment on down to the sub.
Certainly, thank you. And I think Representative Barton maybe should take a look at this law and establish his own little work group to rewrite the statute, you know, in his spare time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And this committee would be happy to entertain your proposal. And then we'd have a subsequent referral to a couple other committees, probably.
No doubt. Actually, if we're still waiting, may I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Just so I understand the process. Obviously, so a homeowner or somebody pays a general contractor who then subcontractor does work. There's thus a contractor's or construction lien attached to it. And this is the problem we're dealing with. Why wouldn't they, instead of go after the contractor's bond? Isn't that why we require, a bonding process in the CC? Is it just the fact that the bond amount is inadequate for the damages at issue?
And that's exactly what, in the two cases that you have on page 18 and 19 of our presentation, they did go after the bond, but in, for instance, the second case, there was a number of other claimants against that bond, and they ended up, you know, with very, very few cents on the dollar. After the contractor, I think in that case, had declared bankruptcy, mm-hmm. So they were gone. There was this $15,000 bond. The one couple alone had about a $90,000 contract claim against the bond, in addition to their $18,000 lien claim, and there were several other parties that also had complaints. So it's one of those cases where the damages far exceeded what was available on the bond.
And Representative Barton, there's another issue, and no offense to your profession, but the consumer sometimes...
I'm sure you never would.
No, absolutely not. But the consumer sometimes has paid the general, and they have to hire an attorney to, you know, to go after the situation to get the lien removed, and oftentimes that attorney charges them another set of fees and charges that end up being more expensive than when it started. So they're really in a catch-22 here, not just with the construction industry, but also with the legal industry as well. And that disturbs me as well.
Mr. Chair.
They were perfectly innocent in this whole process.
Mr. Chair, now that you've mentioned it, though, I am very concerned about anything that would have an impact on the legal community and might reduce their income. So I think we should be very, very careful.
Representative Winger.
Get over it.
Well, it looks like we're ready to get serious and pay attention to this presentation here. I think it will help in our discussion.
Now, this presentation, Representative Holvey and members of the committee, was prepared for just general presentation to citizens of Oregon that wanted to be a little more educated about the process, so it's a little more general and focused.
So but maybe too advanced for us, huh?
So this generally just says that what a construction lien is that they can get this if the contractor and others who provided services were not paid, then they can make a claim against the property. So what comes up is that if the contractor doesn't pay subcontractors, employees, rental equipment people, material suppliers, and there are others like architects and engineers who may end up with a lien right. We are really talking about the pay twice situation. Liens actually come in two flavors. One is if you don't pay your general contractor, the person you had a direct contract with. We're not talking about that situation. You have lots of control over that. And in that case, you're only if you haven't paid, then you're talking about a pay once situation, and I don't think anybody would argue that contractor has a valid claim against you and your property. We're talking about the situation where you paid the general and the general didn't pay somebody that they either hired to do the work or that they bought material from. It's usually subcontractors and material suppliers. Construction liens ensure that people are paid for the value they add to someone else's property. And this is why I think that we started to develop this process more than 100 years ago. If you buy a car and the bank and you don't pay for the car, then the bank could come after your car. If you have some repair work done on your car, you give the car to the garage, and if you don't pay, they won't give it back. But that's not the problem where work is actually done on real estate, where you just can't reclaim the work. It would be a bad solution to say that if a contractor isn't paid for that siding job, they can walk onto your property, muscle you aside, and tear the siding off your house. That would be more than disruptive. So one of the things in theory that you should do if you have a home project is that you need to verify that all of the people that your contractor is paying, or sometimes their subcontractors are owed money to, are getting paid. And
okay. Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Winger.
Can you go back to that slide?
I think so. Yep.
Why are you paying a general contractor? Or what are you paying a general contractor for if you have to make sure that all these subs get paid?
Well, that would be, in the ideal world, you should be able to trust your general contractor to do this work and to pay off all of their people. But unfortunately, we see not a huge number, but a fair number of cases where that doesn't happen for various reasons. And sometimes it's somebody who just doesn't know the difference between profit and cash flow, and so they take that money and treat it as theirs instead of paying it out. Other people are actually more nefarious, and they really are sort of running a scam on their customer. And then other people, they are suddenly faced with like medical bills or something that they just feel has priority over the obligation to pay the people that they've employed to do the work on your home. But and people either justify this in their own mind or they don't. I don't know why, how it happens, but there's lots of reasons why people don't properly pay their subcontractors and material people. So we'll go on. These are the people that can record a construction lien. As I said, the primary people are subcontractors and material suppliers. Most of these other people are a little more rare. You do see them every so often. Okay, in order to have a right, now, and we're still talking, remember, we're talking about sort of the third party here, not the owner and the prime contractor, but we're talking about subs and material people, that in order for them to have a right to file that lien against you, that they have to provide certain notices. The primary contractor has to give an information notice to owner about construction liens, and that is designed to tell people what a construction lien is and what they need to do. That is on page 11 of your materials, is the notice they have to give. The next thing is the notice of right to lien, and we talk about that in that information notice. The notice of right to lien is given by the material supplier or the subcontractor And it covers any work they've done in the last 8 days and forward from that date. And they cannot file a lien for anything that's been done prior to that date. The reason that this notice is given is to give the homeowner an opportunity to protect him or herself by taking several steps. And I think that at the end, this is what the primary contractor has to give, and I'm just going to kind of skip through these. The information notice to homeowner has to be given if there's more than $1,000 worth of work, and if they don't, then they forfeit their right to the lien. Subcontractors have to give the notice of right to lien, which I've been talking about. It's not a lien. It just tells you that they have a right to record a lien, and that they can do that later on. And they also, it gives them a little more information about the lien law. It's and I mentioned that it covers anything done for the period after 8 days before the notice is given. This part of the presentation, I'm going to get to the part that what the owners can do to protect themselves. This part of the presentation was just to let people know that it's difficult to file a lien correctly. It's real easy. There's quite a few defenses to it. If you, for instance, overstate the amount, you can lose the lien entirely. There's a question about attorney fees. In a lien action, the winner has to, or the loser has to pay the other side's attorney fees. That's assuming they have any money to do so with. And so because of the complexity of it, you generally need to talk to an attorney. The lien is filed by recording it with the county clerk, and it has to be filed within 75 days of either substantial completion on the whole job or completion of the work of the person who did the subs work on the project. They have to notify mortgage holders if they're going to have a right that would be over and above the mortgage holder, and otherwise the mortgage would be first in line, and so that wouldn't be very useful to anybody. Within 120 days, they have to file the lawsuit to foreclose the lien. But what is a foreclosure action? That means that you're asking the court, if nobody does anything, to sell the property and then divvy up the proceeds. So they would actually auction the property. The sheriff's office would do this, and then they would pay off any liens and any loans due, and then give the owner anything that was left over, which is usually nothing. We tell people that if they get a notice of lien against their property, that they should go ahead and contact an attorney. We've had some over the last 30 years that I've been in Oregon. We've had some sad cases where people just didn't do anything and they literally lost their house. And by the time that it reached the newspaper article, then it was usually too late to do anything. Basically, that says the worst can happen. There is a way to do what they call bond around a lien, where you pay a bond company to put up a certain amount that's usually some multiple of what the lien is for, and then it takes the cloud off the title of your home, and then what's happening then is that the fight is over access to this bond, which is usually somewhat of a relief to people. And then this is what I wanted to get to. One of the ways you can protect yourself once you get this notice of right to lien, remember that's the notice that comes early on in the process and is not a lien itself, is to require that when you pay your prime contractor that you get a release back from all of their subs and any material suppliers that would essentially release those people be releasing their lien rights, because they've made some arrangements to make sure that that money that goes to the prime contractor flows through to them. And that's probably the preferred way to do this, but it's complicated because somebody has to draft up that release. They vary from project to project, and usually on large projects, the owners will hire an attorney to make sure that those releases are drafted in a way that protects the owner's interests. So that is certainly one way to do it. A more common way is to write a joint check, which means that you would talk to your contractor and say, okay, you're asking me to pay you $20,000. What's that for? And the person says, well, you know, $10,000 of it went into buying the windows and another $5,000 for the lumber, and then there's $5,000 which is for the labor that I put into the project so far. So you say, okay, well, I know that you've got a bill due to Par Lumber for $5,000, and you've got a bill due to the $10,000. I'm going to write out three checks. One of them is going to be to you for the $5,000 for your employees. The other one is going to be to you and Par Lumber for the $5,000 for the lumber that I've provided. So it's a joint check, and that means when they, in order for them to negotiate that check, they're going to have to get signatures from both Par Lumber, and they're going to have to put their own on it as well. So that, you know, you've got some proof when that check comes back that Par Lumber was paid for the lumber they provided, and that will be a defense against any lien they might want to assert later on. Same way with the window company, you'd write a joint check to the window company and your contractor, same deal. They'd have to, in order to negotiate that check, they would have to go ahead and provide essentially proof that that money went to the party that it was supposed to go to. So that is the most common way for small projects, and for particularly for homeowners to do it. But that requires that they do some research and have a good relationship with their prime contractor. And frankly, even though it's a relatively simple concept, it's more sophisticated than most people know how to do to deal with. And usually, there's the people that get burned on liens have never done the research necessary to even discover this. They had some of the information that would told them how to do this in the notice they received, and they had more information on our website if they had searched for it. But that's not the way they, you know, do business. As a matter of fact, I've had people contact me and say, well, we're a little worried about our contractor. And I said, well, do you have a written contract with the contractor? It's for $174,000 to build a house. And they said, no, we don't. We just did it on a handshake. Well, if they're going to do that on a handshake, they probably aren't going to take the trouble to do this either. So, so it's a matter of the strategy so far has been to educate Oregonians as best we can to, you know, how to handle the possibility of the pay twice situation and how to protect themselves. And it's to basically to get people to understand at least as much of the law as they need to know to try to protect themselves in these situations. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. I appreciate you did a pretty good job of going through that. And I'll make one comment and then ask Representative Tomei her question. You know, I notice that educating the public is always a good thing, but I would venture to say that outside of the committee members that were on this last session and myself, who's been in the construction industry, most people don't know that.
I agree.
So the general public really isn't there. So, I mean, that's why I think we need to address this. But anyway, Representative Tomei.
I apologize for having to leave, so maybe you address this. But, as you were talking about, especially building a new home, there are so many subcontractors and so much material that the owner can't know all of the different people who would have an interest in that home.
I agree, Representative Tomei, Representative Holby. It would, on a home project, I gave a simple example of just two material suppliers. On a home project, you could have 20 or more.
Oh, right.
It would be a tremendously difficult job to account for, and it doesn't seem like maybe for many people it would be a very workable situation.
Well, and if I can, Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, I want to make sure that you were aware that on page 5 there's a reference to the 2003 Home Buyers Protection Act that you and your predecessors worked hard on. Then Representative Merkley spent hours with the construction industry and with Bill Boyd to try to come up with some solution, particularly in new construction. Mm-hmm. And I know that the industry and your contractors board is proud of that. The question is, what about the rest and how well this is working? I can't really report to you how well it's working. I can tell you that we are getting an increased number of pay twice complaints, but I think that's a function of smaller jobs and of the economy and the fact that unfortunately contractors in the worst cases are not having the funds to take care of all their business obligations and they're suffering.
Thank you, Representative Matthews.
And I can I can respect the comment that they're suffering, but everybody's suffering. So I guess when I see this, and I told you as a colleague that I wasn't going to ask any common sense questions because I'd heard several of them that those who've been through the process were kind of shaking their head like this has been gone through and I'll rely on their leadership. But the notice of a right to lien, you know, when I look at the projects under $50,000, today's times I think that generally people are starting to maybe refinance, might be thinking about doing that addition on their house, maybe, because contractors right now are kind of struggling, looking to get back to work. What is the responsibility of that contractor? What is the fine if they don't notify you? Because I agree with Chair Holvey on this. I don't think, in fact, I know, having just had three garage doors, a new rock fireplace, and wrought iron in my house, I never heard about this before. And I would sure hate to think that somebody had a right to a lien after I've already paid that check. So what is the consequence for the builders that don't do this?
A couple of points I'd make, Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews. The primary contractors are obligated to give you that information, notice to owner about construction liens. If they don't do that, they are subject to a civil penalty. Every time we get a complaint to the board about bad work, we ask the homeowner if they got those notices, and when we receive indication that they haven't, we penalize that contractor. I think the current penalty is around $200 for the first offense, but it goes up from there, and it depends on whether a lien's been filed or not. And I think we're getting better compliance than we used to. But I can't sit here today and tell you that we have 100% or even close to that compliance, particularly on small jobs. So I think your experience is not out of the norm.
However, if they don't give that notice, they also lose their lien right.
That's the primary contractor. The problem is that the sub, if the sub doesn't get paid, still has that lien right. Now, the sub must provide that this other notice to you, and that's the one on page 13. If you don't get that, that subcontractor's lien is not valid. So in theory, you should be getting a couple of notices telling you you're at risk before you pay that contractor in full.
Is Representative Widener, or follow-up?
Just follow-up, please. So these documents should be, there should be a transfer taking place prior to the work even being started. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews, that's correct. Page 13 is the one that the sub has to provide at the time they are beginning work on the project or within a number of days. The other one is required by the general contractor to give to you at the time the contract is entered into.
And last follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
How would this apply to an out-of-state licensed contractor, say, from Vancouver?
Yeah, great question, Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews. The out-of-state contractors are not allowed to work in Oregon without a CCB license, without an Oregon license. And so, of course, we look at them. They may reside out of state, but they have to abide by the same laws everybody else does.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Matthews, with Representative Barton's help, we have a lien against your place for your extended questioning. But I want to keep this straightforward because everything's black and white. There's not a lot of gray in this issue. How about the guy who, since we are in hard times, that has the contractor's number, his CCB number, and hasn't paid his dues or anything because he hasn't had the money to and he's out doing work and not paying his bills?
It's a good question. If I'm hearing the question right, Chair Holvey, and Representative, the question is, if the
contractor
is not licensed, do they have a lien right? Can you answer that?
I think they still have a lien right.
They may.
But they probably, no, they don't have a lien right because that other law, 102, what used to be 102, prevents it.
His subcontractors
could have a lien right, yes.
That's what I'm getting at, because here's a guy who's suffering hard times. You don't know it. He still has a contractor's number. So he goes and does the work, but he doesn't have the money to pay his subs. So the subs put a lien, and he doesn't even have a valid license. This is probably even a bigger issue than the guys who are paying for their license.
Well, particularly since that owner then would want to make a lien claim against the general contractor for whatever lien they had to pay to the subcontractor, but then they can't do that because they're working with an unlicensed contractor. So they don't have the CCB lien claim that comes through my section to rely on. However, one of the other things we try to educate people on is to always check that contractor's license status before you actually enter into that contract with them, or at least on the day you do.
Well, and if I can just amplify on that, Chair Holvey, today it's more of a problem than ever before, again, because of the economic conditions. The amount of work out there is really shrinking. And what legitimate contractors are asking from us is, for goodness sakes, if we pay our dues and we give the notices and we jump through all the hoops that you have given to us so that we can protect consumers, will somebody please just be out there refereeing so that the bad guys aren't undercutting us? And of course, maybe you know that's what you did last session with your board, is you provided substantial additional resources, some more regulation, but additional resources to go out there and beat the bushes, and that's what we've been doing. It's driving up the amount of civil penalties we're collecting, which may be a benefit for this problem. You can talk about that later, but I can tell you that is the nut of the problem, is what about the contractor that's unlicensed? It's tough out there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
Just to follow up on this question of the unlicensed, I mean, if a contractor is operating unlicensed, it seems to me, maybe my colleagues don't share this sentiment, but it just seems to me that the burden is on the sub to know that that contractor doesn't have a license and to not be doing business with them over the homeowner. I mean, who actually does this for a living, right? I mean, who is in this business every day? Why are we placing the burden on the homeowner to know that this contractor doesn't have a license rather than the sub, who is actually extending credit to this person?
Chair Holvey and Representative Wingard, is a fair comment, and I can tell you that one of the things we've done for the industry is to provide them, obviously, with a website that you all can use and consumers can use to determine whether a contractor is licensed. But we've gone one step further and provided a service to licensed contractors to monitor any amount of contractors they want to. So they can go into their account, if you will, here with CCB, list the contractors they want to watch the license for, their generals that they work for in that case, or their subs, and they will get an email every time that license becomes inactive. The moment it becomes inactive, and we refresh that data twice a day. So we're, you know, I think your point's a good one. We've got some tools for those folks.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I hate to keep asking questions, but In the scenario, is there ever a case where an employee who doesn't get paid by the sub has a right to put a lien on the property?
That's a good question. I'll have to give it to Bill.
Representative Holvey, employees do have a right to place a lien. The reason we don't see very well, I can't remember ever seeing one, is because it's a fairly sophisticated thing to do, and most employees don't have the knowledge to be able to do it. And they also, I believe, would have to give a notice of right to lien, and they haven't done that either.
And I'll provide a follow-up to that. So,
follow-up?
Thank you. An employee in a case will sometimes seek out wage and hour or somebody else out to help them get paid, and does it sometimes happen that a state agency would try to perfect a lien for that employee?
Can you talk about the CCB?
I don't know that the state agency would. They'd have to essentially be representing that employee as an attorney, and most state agencies don't have that right to do that. That employee, as well as going to wage and hour, can also come and file an employee claim with us. And we get a small number of claims every year that are filed by employees.
Okay, thank you.
Chair.
Representative Gilliam?
Sorry for that outburst. But
that's one.
I know. Representative Riley was kind of dozing there, and I just wanted to help out. I just wanted to have a quick question here, Craig. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I think we had a phone line installed for you last time in the office there, but anyway, maybe you won't be here that much this time. Numbers. Just give a little context to refresh my memory and for new ones. How many jobs are going on in a given year in Oregon, and how many, rough numbers are fine, and how many end up in this category, where specifically is there a problem with paying twice?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, we have about 45,000 contractors currently licensed. I pray that they're most days they're working, okay? In some cases, some contractors are doing more than one project a day. Obviously, if you're building a home, it may take you months. But there are literally thousands of projects in being performed every day, being completed every day. On page number 16, you'll see the amount of complaints that your construction contractors board fields every quarter. And we have that broken down by the type of complaint that we get. And you can see that we talked about these type of pay twice problems is line 602. And last fiscal year we received 27. And to give some comparison, we received during that same period of time 64 employee claims. It was about half as many as the employees coming to us. And, of course, what we do in those situations is it's not unlike a court situation where if they can prove the damage, we order the contractor to pay, and if the contractor doesn't pay, we take the contractor's license away, and it goes against the bond to the extent that the bond is there. In most cases, the bond will pay, the truth of the matter is that about 50% of the time, the bond is insufficient to cover the damage.
Follow up.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Chair. That's on second, twice pay, what is it? What's our term?
Pay twice.
That's on the pay twice. So what percentage is that of those jobs?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, of course, it's a very small percentage. If we were to discuss the possibility of 100,000 jobs a year, perhaps, something like that, and liens, we receive about 27. That's what we receive. Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. We don't see most of the complaints. And this is the unfortunate part about this is in many cases, consumers get that pay twice, and they worry about the foreclosure, and they pay it, and they don't contact your CCB or their lawyer. They just pay it, and they're quiet about it. I can't tell you how often that happens, but I know that it does.
So I appreciate you keeping after this, but I just wanted people to know this is not a huge problem. It's an important one. I'd sure hate to pay twice, but it ain't exactly huge.
Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. I mean, it's a point that I've brought up before that I believe that the solution to this, in dollar terms, is not huge, but the problem, the image to the industry, to government, and certainly the problem for that individual is huge. And so I think it would bode well for all of us to deal with this. And now I forgot my follow-up. Another question, Representative Matthews.
This is somewhat of a follow-up. Out of the 27, which seems a small number but still important, are there any duplicates in there, meaning any particular contractor that's the bad actor that's really making it tough on everybody who's actually doing legitimate business?
Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews, I'm going to let Bill address that. His memory may tell him more than mine will because he works with this on a daily basis.
Okay. Representative Matthews, Representative Holvey, I believe that there are some duplicates in that 27, that there's because we treat each claim, lien claim, separately, even if it's, there might be two or three against the same contractor. That doesn't happen very often, but I'm sure there are. I also wanted to add, while we're looking at that line, we had 27 in the previous fiscal year, which ended last June. We've had 11th in the fifth quarter, and we just ran this morning. We had an additional 8 in the sixth quarter, so we're a little faster on, we're running a little higher number in this first half of, or the last half of last calendar year.
So a question, do all these kinds of claims have to go through the Construction Contractors Board? Could some of them go a different direction to the court?
Yeah, Representative Holvey, that I would guess that there's probably another, you know, that this is about half of what's, just as a pure guess, there's about half of the lien claims, and the rest of them are in the court system.
So they don't, all the claims don't come through the CCB?
Right. And then there'd be this other part that Craig mentioned that are settled rather than ever go to court or to the CCB.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, for example, the parallel processes of the CCB dispute resolution versus the court, that's not either or. Aren't they usually parallel processes, i.e. there's litigation happening, but they also go after the bond or also file a complaint with CCB to maximize leverage?
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Representative Barton, Representative Holvey, there are some of our lien claims are both in court and in front of us at the same time. As a matter of fact, there's a special provision where if you're in court, you can get the court to stay the foreclosure action so that you can get resolve the bond problem and get your money in hand so that when the court does order you to pay it, you can at least pay out what you've received from the CCB bond. However, I would say the majority of our lien claims are not in court. They're that they've already paid them off. So what they're coming back is for reimbursement.
Thank you. I'll let you continue because I think you've exhausted the questions for the moment.
Well, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that really is the gist of our presentation. I can tell you that we are very pleased that you're choosing to spend some time on this. I think you have realized that, A, it's not a huge problem. B, though probably does beg for some more attention, and perhaps there is something else that we can do, because the problem is that it doesn't feel right, is the bottom line. It just doesn't feel right, particularly from a consumer protection agency and from a public policy standpoint. And I've got some friends who look at it a little differently, and there is another side to this, and you've talked about that. You've talked about the fact that I think that, subcontractors deserve to be paid once. And they have it lien right, and there's a reason for it. And you didn't hear about this, but I can tell you that what I was taught years ago is that, there used to be a difference between the power structure, and the power was in the hands of people who had property. And businesses didn't have that. And so lien rights were huge in terms of commerce then, because it's in order to provide that service, you needed to have a right to collect that money. Now, have times changed enough? Have the powers shifted? I can't tell you. What I can tell you is that the consumers that face this problem and talk to us, they wonder why the law is the way it is today, and sometimes we have a hard time explaining it.
Thank you, Craig. I think you do bring up a good point that these laws are out there to protect people who are performing services on good faith that they're going to get paid, and it still happens that people do services out there in the world and they don't get paid and they don't have much recourse without a lien law. So, I think that's an extremely important point to make and one that this committee has to wrestle with as well in trying to come up with a balance on this. I'm curious if you have any further comments specifically about the bill, and I know we've discussed, some different ideas that we might incorporate, but if you want to spend a couple minutes just on the bill specifically, you don't need to, but if you have just some ideas you want to throw out there, I'd welcome you to do that.
Great. Chair Holvey, a couple of things that we might want to consider as you struggle with this is if you choose to explore this further, you might want to address the funding source. We do have, this is set up to tax or surcharge all residential licensees, and it's set up currently so that we would have to borrow money from the general fund and then repay that. It's a little bit complicated. If you chose to stay with the tax of residential contractors, I'd suggest not borrowing from the general fund. Let's just raise the money over a year period and see how much comes together, and then allocate that against the losses. You might look at different funding structures. What's been talked about in the past and makes a lot of sense, I think, to the Construction Contractors Board and others is to use the civil penalties that we assess. And we are doing better and better. Unfortunately, not all contractors are abiding by the law, and so they do get some penalties. And over the course of this biennium, we've collected over $1 million. And all that money goes to the general fund, except for 20% that we keep to feed our collections process and to collect that money. But there is some funds there that if you and your colleagues choose, you might want to tap for a fund like this.
Wow. That's a good idea. Can I make a comment?
I just thought you just did, yeah. The wow. Representative Gilliam, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wow, good idea. No, would you entertain replacing that scheme for this bill?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, if I'm hearing you right, we'd entertain anything, you know, of course. I would recommend that you strongly consider the funding coming from perhaps the collection of civil penalties rather than taxing or surcharging all of the contractors.
All righty.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. I guess the question is, will this committee entertain that?
So. It is. It was misplaced.
Thank you. So have we got any other questions for Craig Smith and Mr. Boyd from the Construction Contractors Board at this point? Doesn't seem like it. Craig, I really want to thank you for putting this together and coming aboard with this. I really am serious about trying to come up with some sort of solution on this issue, because I think it really is damaging to some people, individuals who end up potentially and in the past have lost their homes over this particular issue. And certainly we don't want to minimize the importance of that. Even if it only happens once, it's once too many times. And it doesn't do the industry any good. It doesn't do our state government any good. And we really need to get a handle on this, I believe. So with that, I thank you again for the work you put into this presentation, and Mr. Boyd as well. I really appreciate it. It was pretty thorough, and I think it gave us a good basis to for this committee to start looking at this bill.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. And I believe we have a couple more that are signed up to testify, and I'd like to have them come up at the moment, Scott Berry and Stephen Kafori. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Of course. Good afternoon. Scott Berry, representing the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I'll first comment that I think Craig did an excellent job of kind of going over lien law, going over the problems that exist today with lien law, aside from this issue specifically, but just lien law in general. It gets very complicated. As Representative Barton had mentioned, in fact, I was wondering if Representative Barton might not turn that in for a CLE credit later on in the year. This is a really decent concept that, frankly, a number of years ago, the Oregon Home Builders Association introduced and then followed up again with the Construction Claims Task Force. At that time, and Representative Gilliam has already mentioned this, the funding would have come from the civil penalty money. Currently, the Building Codes Division, for instance, today, which also licenses contractors and licenses plumbers, electricians, and other contractors for their professional license, as opposed to licensing them as contractors under the state. And there's some subtle differences between those two. My point there is that the Building Codes Division keeps their civil penalty money and uses it for things that they need within that budget. The Construction Contractors Board civil penalty money does not stay with the Contractors Board for the most part. It goes back into the general fund. From a contractor's point of view, we look at that as money that's generated from contractors who are not necessarily doing what they should have been doing. And for having that money go to satisfy these lien claims makes all the sense in the world to us. And that seems like the simplest way to deal with this problem. We're already facing a fee increase at the Construction Contractors Board this year. We've got a declining number of contractors. We've got more enforcement and more pressure on the Contractors Board from, as the chair knows, all the legislation that passed last session. And those expenses are leading to a fairly good size increase at the Construction Contractors Board for all contractors. I think our interest in adding then another fee of to the contractors who aren't causing the problem for maybe 15 or 20 contractors who are causing this problem does cause us some concern. It's the bad contractors paying for the folks, the good contractors paying for the folks who are causing a problem. It's a very small number of folks. Again, that civil penalty money going to pay those liens seems to make sense to us, and it's been a concept that we've supported in times past. The way this bill is written, we would want to make sure that this was a fund just for consumers. I think that's important, that it's not something that's open to subs and suppliers. Typically, what happens in a lien situation is it's often not involving the general contractor. It involves the supplier. I'm going through a remodel project right now at my house, and I'm getting lien notices. I think those, just getting a notice of a right to lien from a material supplier can sometimes be a frightening thing for the consumer. They don't realize that that's not actually a lien on their property. They get concerned about that and hopefully follow up and ask more questions of their general contractor. But typically those liens are coming from the HVAC contractor or the roofing supplier, who is extending credit to that subcontractor with the understanding that they'll then pay that bill. So it doesn't just happen from general to sub in terms of the sub not getting paid. Often it's down to the supplier who supplied that without and really gave the credit to the subcontractor. So I just wanted to clarify that a little bit. Finally, this is an issue, as you've already discussed, and I think you really covered most of the issues on lien law and how the consumer is affected. But this issue was taken care of for the vast majority of new construction with now Senator Merkley's bill from 2003/2004, because we did make some corrections in the special session. But that gave the option to the builders to supply the consumer with one of, I think, five or six options to make sure that consumer did not end up with a lien. In the end, almost all of our builders use a small title insurance policy that the banks have been using for years. And that little policy says, and again, it's protecting the banks for years against that same sort of thing. If the bank were to end up with that piece of property, they don't want those liens against that property either. There's a small insurance policy that our builders now offer to it's part of the contract, part of the deal, that protects those consumers for that 75 days after the completion of the project. And that's all there is in terms of the timeline for those rights to be or that lien to be perfected. And so it takes care of itself, and it's not an issue. I believe the number is under 50,000, and again, that came up earlier. So it's remodel projects under 50,000 where this comes up. I don't know the numbers on those 27 from the 2007-2008 biennium, how much money that was. But after Craig just mentioned the amount of money that's coming from civil penalties, I would guess that would more than make up for the amount that's left over after the bond is gone. Again, after the bond is gone, those folks are out of business. These are folks typically who've gone bankrupt or have lost their license in, I think, every case, because once you lose your bond, you're not going to get it back. So these are folks who have typically gone bankrupt or are no longer in business, and it's that small number of folks that are injured by those contractors that this would address. Happy to take any questions.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Scott, I have a couple of questions, if I may, Mr. Chair. One of them is, why wouldn't that cover the subs? You said it protects the homeowner, but not the, or the, no, the suppliers, but not the subs.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, I think our interest in finding a solution would be to find a solution for the homeowner who's made the payment, and not to get into the agreements between the subs and the general in terms of the purpose of this fund. The last thing I think our interest would like to see is this very large fund of money that then attracts more folks to it. And historically, this type of recovery fund, if you will, that's been available on a larger basis has not worked out in other states. So I think making sure that is specific to one group of people, in this case the consumer, and making sure once they've paid on a twice pay system, they're not getting hit again is our chief concern with this bill.
Follow up. So I'm having a little trouble following that, Scott, because I'm especially concerned about the small business owner who would be more likely to be a subcontractor. So why wouldn't it be in our best interest and their best interest to make sure that they're covered?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, I think the interest of the bill, at least the intent of the bill, was to avoid the twice pay system. I don't know of many scenarios where the subcontractor is paying for, you know, ends up in that twice pay system that the consumer does, where they've paid the general contractor, the general doesn't pay the sub doesn't pay the supplier, and then it comes back to the homeowner because there's a lien on the property, and then that homeowner then pays again. I hope that answers your question.
No, maybe not, but we can talk offline.
Okay. Great. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can... I'd like to follow up on hers. What really happens with that insurance policy is that it pays the person who has the lien so that they don't get it from the consumer. Isn't that right?
Generally, Representative Riley, are you talking about the insurance?
Yes.
Policy? The insurance policy assures that the homeowner will not have to pay for any unpaid liens on the property. And it basically is a small 75-day policy that says if any liens come up, once the house is sold, it goes through a title search. So any liens that are on there would get cleared before it could be sold. It's just that possibility that somebody might have an unpaid claim or lien that had not been perfected yet, meaning they filed their notice of right to lien, but they hadn't perfected it until after the home was sold.
And that policy pays that lien.
That's correct.
They pay the subcontractor who has the lien.
Chair Holder, Representative Riley, that's accurate.
Thank you.
So, Scott, you had mentioned that other states that have tried this type of recovery fund has not been successful. Can you identify some of those states that have tried this kind of a recovery fund?
Chair Holder, that sort of research was from the 2007 session. I'd be happy to go back and take a look. And those are typically funds that are broader in scope and tend to apply to any construction defect and not just to a lien. So I think, again, in terms of our support of a concept like this, depending on how it's funded, it's based partly on the fact that we don't want a large recovery fund that sits out there and potentially is open to attorney's fees and other things that may deplete the fund without solving the problem, which we believe is making sure the consumer doesn't have to pay twice.
Right. I was just curious what other states had recovery funds and what their experiences were with it.
Happy to get that to you.
Thank you. Mr. Kapoori.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kapoori. I'm here today representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. The Oregon Remodelers Association has, from its very inception, been concerned about consumer protection. In fact, we were instrumental in getting Construction Contractors Board, then called the Builders Board, established in the first place. It's not because we're an altruistic organization, it's because we're concerned about our own business. And when we're in a business, as we are, that is basically a low-bid business, it's really important that we're operating on a level playing field with people who are obeying the law. And if there are people who are not, we can't compete equally against them. So we're very concerned about consumer protection, that make sure everyone is doing what they ought to be doing. We've been working on this issue for a long, long time, long before I was with the Oregon Remodelers Association. I've been around this building since 1973, and I don't think there's been a session when the pay twice hasn't come up as a topic of discussion. It's a real conundrum how to resolve this issue. We would be more than willing to be a part of any solution. We deplore the situation where people have to pay twice. It's something we don't like. One potential solution, as we always say, is don't always go off to the low bid. When you're looking for a general contractor, take a look and do some research at who you're getting after and who you're getting to fix your home. Make sure that person has some financial security and that information is available. It's not like it's hidden somewhere. The CCB has a lot of information to help people make judgments. But that being said, most people probably have never heard of the CCB and don't know that there's a website that they can find out about contractors, and I think the legislature has an obligation to do what it can to help protect consumers. Well, we feel that very strongly. We'd like to be part of that process.
Thank you. I have one question for you. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the new home situation that sort of takes care of this problem. Why did that bill not include the smaller projects and remodels and things? Either of you were probably...
I was not involved, Mr. Chairman, because it didn't involve us.
Chair Holley, I'll try to recall. I don't know. I mean, that may be something that we'll have to go back and kind of take a look at the notes from 2003, 2004 and figure that out. Our issue was obviously solving it for the new construction, although we represent remodelers as well. But I don't necessarily recall, unless, and I can go back and try to find out whether that early issue title insurance wouldn't have been able to be, wasn't something you could get for those smaller remodels. I don't know the answer, but I'm happy to try to put some time into figuring it out. Well,
certainly we have staff that we can look for that too, but and it might be interesting from the
there was bonding the Home Builders Association that were available, so that may not have been it.
Yeah. I would think maybe both your organizations might have somebody who has knowledge of that.
Be happy to check that out.
History.
Just also, Mr. Chair, I wanted to add that we have continually been in favor, session after session, of increasing the bond, and we did just last session do that. And we think that's a very valuable protection for homeowners, and in most cases it works.
Mm. Yeah, just one other point on that, Chair Holvey, and part of the reason that something like this in some cases may work better than the increase of a bond is fairly simple in terms of the mathematics. To raise the bond another... let's say from $20,000 to $30,000 on a general contractor, it might cost the general contractor another $50 to $100 for that bond. Not a lot of money. But when you multiply that times the 45,000 contractors, you just cost contractors $4.5 million for what is for a problem that's maybe, a small percentage of that. Mm. In other words, it might be a $500,000 problem. I don't know what the number is. We'll have to figure that out with regard to the 27 claims from the 07-08 session. But
well, thank you for that suggestion. I know there's a lot of other problems in our agencies that still deal with businesses in general that could probably figure out what to do with that money right now.
I have no doubt.
So, Representative Riley.
Hey, Mr. Chair, one quick question for Scott. I'm intrigued by this policy that you talked about. Can you tell me the approximate cost for that 75-day policy that you...
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, I believe that when we were researching that, it was somewhere in the... $200 range, although I know depending on the relationship that builders have with their with the companies that do title insurance for them, that may be based on that relationship, and I don't know that it's across the board charged at a $200 to $300 level. I'm not sure.
Okay, I would assume, if I may, I would assume that it is based on the cost of the project. And if you can find that information for me, I'd really appreciate it.
I don't believe that it is, but I will get that information either way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wingard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stephen, Scott, either one of you can try to answer this question. Just back away from where the law is, just from a straight theoretical
standpoint. I've just refinanced my home and pulled out some money, and I'm going to use it to build a deck, rebuild the deck on the back of my house. I hire a general contractor to do that, and he tells me labor, materials, everything, it's going to be, you know, $14,650, and I write a check to him. And he goes off and hires other people and subs and gets the thing done or doesn't, you know, whatever. It gets done, and then a subcontractor comes back and puts a lien on my house because he or she didn't get paid. Can you explain to me why that would happen? I mean, why is that legally possible for a sub to do? Why am I put in the middle of a relationship between the general contractor and the subs that he or she chooses to hire?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wimgard, you may recall John Dillinger's favorite famous saying about why does he rob banks, and he said, because that's where the money is. You put a lien against property that's available, and if you're doing some work on somebody's house, and you have bought, for example, you're the HVAC person, you bought some HVAC, and you paid your money for it, and you stuck it in that house, then that's the only place you can go to get it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
This was my question is, why in the law do you have a right to come after? Where is the theory? I'm looking for an explanation as to why we allow this in the law, and rather than saying to the sub, your relationship is with the contractor, and you know you have a right of action against that person in the law, lean on their property, you know, to go after them. I'm trying to get somebody to explain to me why we, what's the theory behind allowing a subcontractor to put a lien on my home for services that I paid for?
The theory behind it is that if you do some work for someone, you should have the ability to get paid back for that work. And you've produced something. You've given him some HVAC, some pieces of galvanized metal that go into that guy's home. It's not practical to go and grab that stuff and take it out. That would be the easy way. So the next best thing is to attach it to the property. And that's it. I've done the work on that property. You have the value. You're the owner of the house. You've got the value of it. I've done the work, and I've supplied the materials for it. If I don't get paid, I want my materials and my labor back. And you're the one with the beneficiary because you're the homeowner that's got that house that's all fixed up. You got the new deck or whatever. That's where we should get the property from. That's the theory behind it. You can disagree with it, but that's the history.
One more time, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
My question is that I have paid for this. So if you chose to give credit, if you're the subcontractor, HVAC, and you put this out without asking for the money up front, that was a business decision that you made, and you're the person who hasn't paid you is the general contractor, not me. So I'm still trying to figure out why we would allow the sub to have a right of action against me, the homeowner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, some people have made the argument, and it's a reasonable one, that the burden ought to be on the subcontractor to check the creditworthiness of the general contractor before he goes ahead and makes a loan. That's a reasonable point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Winger, and thank you for that line of questioning. I mean, that is a philosophical issue we have, and I will tell you that from Mr. Kefouri and probably Scott's point of view and many that the labor and the goods that go into producing an asset deserve to be paid. And
so ask for the money up front.
So obviously you could ask for the money up front, but not many people will pay you up front for something because you may just walk away without having a product. So I mean that could hurt the consumer almost as bad or hurt somebody else. So I mean it's what comes first, the chicken or egg situation for sure.
If it's a subject he's not familiar with.
So in any respect, I appreciate you coming forward today and testifying. I'd like to bring Craig Smith back up just for a brief moment. I had a question that came back to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. you.
Mr. Chair.
Matthews.
This is more probably a question for the folks that have been here for quite some time, but is there any other industry that we deal with that operates in this fashion?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of liens in the world.
There are mechanics liens. Mm. There are many, many kinds of liens.
Any other industry, a supplier can go.
But attorneys.
No, not.
But the follow-up, when you talk about a mechanic, if I were to take my car to get repaired, and I paid the shop, and they didn't pay their employee doesn't have a right to come after my car.
Yes, they do. They can put a lien, just like they did the work. Anyway,
we're talking about houses right now. I don't want to get too far from my brain here. Thank you for coming back up. I was just curious. We went through this whole exercise, and there was some comments made. You know, even on your slideshow, that the consumer should verify that the subs have been paid, and that raised a question in my mind. Does the consumer oftentimes doesn't really know who the subs are or who the suppliers are? Does the consumer have the right, or does the general contractor have the responsibility to provide that list of suppliers and subcontractors to the owner?
There's an answer to that, and Bill's going to give it here in a minute. But on top of that, remember that the sub, except for the employee, the sub and supplier have to give right to lien notices. Mm-hmm. So and that has to be given to the owner. Otherwise, they lose their right to go after that property, that pay-twice situation. So in theory, the consumer is notified at least once. Now, the question has to do with, well, can you get a list? Are they obligated if you ask for that? And Bill might be able to answer that.
Representative Holby, probably not. I've seen commercial contracts that specify that you have to list all this information, unless it's in the contract, you probably have the prime contractor probably has no duty to disclose their suppliers and their subcontractors to the owner. But that's the reason for the notice of right to lien, so that you do get a list of the ones that actually now have a right because they provided you that list. And you probably then would have to call up each one of those people, the Par Lumber, and say, what are you owed on this job? And then you would want to, that's where the joint check comes in.
Yeah, that was the bulk of my question.
Again, Chair Holby, we'd be happy to work with you or your staff or anybody else that's interested in this matter. We'll make ourselves available.
Well, certainly I appreciate that, because I think it's going to take some of your input, as well as Mr. Berry's and Mr. Kapori's and probably a few others that aren't here, to take a closer look at this. And the funding mechanism is worth thinking about, too. You know, I understand the desire to have this come from penalty monies, but of course penalty monies come out of the general fund, and you know, our general fund right now is experiencing a little bit of stress. And so anyway, we'll work on those issues and try to deal with this. Thank you very much for your testimony today. It's been actually, I told the committee this would be a riveting committee hearing, and I don't think you let us down. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on the House Bill 2366? Seeing nobody jumping up, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2366. Colleagues, on Monday, my committee staff has this ready to go. We are having a hearing on which ones of these? We will be having a hearing on House Bill 2191 and 2368. These are bills dealing with debt management services. And it's my intention to carry over House Bill 2354 as well to Monday. And I hope you enjoy your Friday.
We will.
With that, the House Committee on Consumer Protection
stands adjourned for February 4th.